Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The rate of marriage in the United States is shrinking, but millennials, as the current coming-of-age demographic, aren't opposed to the tradition. They are marrying later in life than their parents, and their values and beliefs about marriage reflect other cultural changes. Joining us by phone is Associate Professor at Brigham Young University and author of a new book entitled The Marriage Paradox, Why Emerging Adults Love Marriage Yet Push It Aside, Brian Willoughby. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
They love the idea but are putting it off. As I read it, much of this behavior is for practical reasons.
Right, exactly. There's a lot of economic aspects at play for emerging adults. A lot of them, more than ever before, are going to college. More of them than ever before are, though, also worried about their career prospects post-college graduation. They know that the career prospects for a lot of emerging adults and young adults in their early and mid-20s are not that good. And a lot of them are worried about what marriage might mean if they make that transition too soon.
And a lot of them are burdened with a lot of debt after college, more than ever.
Yes, exactly. And there's a strong sense for young adults that marriage, and this is a big change we've seen from the previous generation, is one generation, two generations ago, marriage was something that you might do, even if you weren't necessarily completely financially ready or stable. There was more of a sense that I'm going to build something with my spouse. And now for most young adults, there's a sense that marriage is kind of one of the last things you do. It's a thing you do when you're stable, when you have a stable career, when you're getting out of debt, when you have substantial savings in the bank. And that's been one of those shifts as well. And so that student debt that so many students are carrying out of college is also another important contributor.
That's the shift that surprised me the most, this sense of everything has to, you have to have all your ducks in order. What do we know about why that occurred?
Well, one of the big conclusions I came to doing the research that resulted in the book was that, and really the book started with me and some of my colleagues noting that despite the fact that the marriage rate's been declining, there's this general sense that young adults today are pushing marriage aside, maybe not caring about marriage. They continually tell us that marriage is one of the most important things in their life. They plan to do it, and that rate actually hasn't changed for decades. But as I tried to explore why that was happening, one of the things that occurred to me as I interviewed and talked to young adults and did the research I did for the book is that marriage today, when a young adult says that they want to get married and they're planning for marriage, they're talking about a very different type of relationship than their parents or grandparents did. And the type of relationship they're talking about is one that's very much based on principles of individualism, of individual happiness and individual satisfaction. And so because marriage has become less about a societal good for most emerging adults and more about something that I'm going to get something out of, that's where we've seen that shift to, I want to make sure everything else is set before I get married, because marriage is supposed to kind of be then that cherry on top where everything else is figured out. I've got a good job, I've got a stable life, and then the spouse and my marriage is going to contribute to my individual happiness.
Is this like an idealization of marriage?
Yeah. In fact, one of the things I talk about in the book is that, shockingly to me and some others, this isn't really about young adults pushing marriage or disregarding marriage or devaluing marriage. In some ways, it's the current generation valuing marriage almost too much. Like you said, idealizing marriage to such a degree where marriage is set up to have these very unrealistic expectations where it's going to be a relationship that's happy all the time, that gives me joy and satisfaction. And everything we know about long-term marriage suggests that that's not the case. Marriage is about hard work and ups and downs and more about long-term commitment, despite, in many cases, individual happiness. But that's not what a lot of young adults have in their head.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about marriage and what the tradition means going forward with this new demographic, this new coming-of-age demographic of millennials. My guest is Brian Willoughby. He's an associate professor at Brigham Young University and author of a new book entitled The Marriage Paradox, Why Emerging Adults Love Marriage Yet Push It Aside. If you have a question or comment, if you're a millennial, give us a call and tell us what you think about what we're talking about. Is this Is this you? Are we talking about you right now? Are you putting aside marriage, putting it off, waiting till everything's just perfect before you take the leap? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is there any evidence that this is a good thing for the survival of marriage?
Well, it depends on how you want to define good. I mean, one of the things we know from the research on marriage is that waiting until you're a little bit older, waiting until you're more stable, does have an impact on divorce probability in a positive direction. That the longer people wait, the more stable financially, career-wise they are, that does tend to lower someone's probability of ending a divorce. So on the one hand, that would be positive. On mm-hmm. the other hand, we also know that the longer people wait, there's also evidence that would suggest that they're more likely to be less happy in their marriage. That if I wait for longer in my life course, where I'm more established in my life, it's harder to intertwine my life with someone else. If I've been in my career for a decade and I've been used to being a single person on my own, being independent, and I marry someone that's also been living independent with a career as an adult for a decade, that intertwining of lives can sometimes be a little bit more difficult. And so in some ways, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. There is some potential stability benefits, but there's also some potential satisfaction and happiness risk, which again is ironic, because a lot of young adults are delaying marriage with the hope that that will make them more satisfied and more happy.
How have current dating trends affected the trajectory toward marriage for millennials?
Yeah, that's been another major contributor. We've seen the dating trends in the 20s radically shift, and there's been several components to that. One is in the early 20s, particularly in a lot of college cultures, we have seen the growth of what's been called the hookup culture, where a lot of college students have kind of pushed aside the more committed long-term stable relationships in favor of more casual relationships, friends with benefits, sexual hookups, kind of having fun during college. We know that most of them age out of that fairly quickly through their early 20s and mid-20s. But even in their mid-20s, when they're looking at more long-term stable committed relationships, again, because marriage has been pushed back, and for most of them, being married in their early to mid-20s is too early. They're not established yet. They have other things they want to do. We're seeing more and more and more of that group turn to cohabitation instead of marriage. While cohabitation and living with a romantic partner used to be very tied to marriage, it was something you did maybe to test the relationship out to see if you wanted to marry someone. Most millennials and young adults today are living with their partner simply because they don't want to get married, and they don't even know if they want to marry this partner, but they're in long-term, stable, committed relationships, and that's to them what the next step is. And so we're seeing a very large proportion now of young adult couples that are living with each other without any real consideration of marriage. That's been one of the biggest shifts we've seen.
So they really are kind of playing house.
Yeah, in some ways. Although for them, it's not about a marriage substitute. It really is kind of a placeholder, because again, most of them expect to marry later in life.
Okay.
They expect to make that transition to marriage, but it's something that, hey, I don't want to get married for 8 years, and I still want to be committed to you, and so this is what we're going to do for now.
Have you noticed much of a difference between genders, between men and women in the millennial demographic as far as these attitudes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the very subtle shifts that we've seen, but we have seen it in the last several decades, is a slight shift. Marriage has always been kind of stereotypically seen as the woman thing, that women are going to be more interested in marriage. Women are going to be more invested in planning the wedding and wanting to get the uncommitted. We have this kind of stereotype of the uncommitted guy that doesn't want to make that transition. We've seen a subtle shift actually in the other direction, where now there is some indication that marriage is becoming more and more of a guy thing, that a lot of women now have gotten very strong cultural messages that you don't need a guy in your life. You don't need to be tied down by marriage. Marriage is a transition of loss, if anything, that could get in your way. And we are seeing now a little bit of a shift where now more men are a little bit more positive about marriage than women, which is something we haven't seen in the past. Although it is still fairly even. Those differences aren't very large.
I'm going to turn to a caller right now. David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Hi, I just had a comment. I just got married in March of this year. And I'd been with my girlfriend, now my wife, for about 5 years. And I kind of wanted to echo the sentiments you guys are talking about. A lot of the millennials nowadays, they have much different aspirations for marriage, as you guys were saying. A lot of us want a career first, and they want a more stable background as far as finances go before we jump into marriage, because as you can tell, weddings are extremely expensive nowadays. Even just a regular base wedding can cost thousands of dollars. So I think that, along with a lot of our parents recently divorced, I think a lot of my friends have divorced parents and blended families. So I think also that changed their view on marriage as they grew up. So just wanted to get your comments on how that maybe has affected the millennials nowadays.
Before I let you go, David, though, tell me, why is it such a thing to have the big wedding? Why is that still so such an important thing?
I'm not sure exactly. I think as soon as we started to look into having a traditional wedding with inviting all of our friends and families, we got bombarded by, I guess, would be the wedding, just the whole, business of weddings now is just a multi-billion-dollar business.
Right.
So, you know, there's so many different apps and so many different things to pay for and to add on to your wedding and to do this and this. And I feel like it can get overwhelming for some people. And they might even say, you know what, let's not even get married. Let's just, you know, live together. Or some people might want to go down to the courthouse instead of, you know, paying, you know, thousands of dollars to get married. So that might scare people off a little bit.
Interesting. David, thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah. Brian Willoughby, what about that? Just the actual getting married, the exchange of vows in and of itself is overwhelming.
Yeah, it can be. And like you said, that wedding cost can be a financial barrier for a lot of couples. And even though it's interesting, a lot of couples will say, you know, it's not that big of a deal for me to have the nicest flowers and the nicest catering. There is a sense of getting kind of caught up, as you said, in that wedding industry. And the wedding industry has been very good at marketing this sense of you don't want to be the one couple amongst all your friends that doesn't have this, this, and this. And that's very much on the mind of a lot of young adults, is that it's not even just, is this the right relationship and what's going to happen after the wedding or after the marriage? Do we have enough to get through that bump? And we do know, particularly for low-income and middle-income families and couples, that wedding barrier can be a hindrance to actually tying the knot.
There was something else I wanted to ask David, and I forgot, but just as if you're with somebody, have you noticed any differences in how long people are staying together as a couple before marriage? Is that typical, what David said? They were together for 5 years.
Yes, that is a growing trend, that time period that people are together before marriage is growing. And one of the reasons for that is first off, as we've been saying, that kind of just general desire to delay marriage. And so I'm 23 and I don't want to get married till my late 20s, I'm naturally going to have a longer period. But another piece to that for a lot of young adults, and this goes back to the economic and career piece, and one of the other things that's changed is that for most young adults, there's no longer this sense that when I start my career in a particular location, that's where I'm going to be for the rest of my career. I'm going to spend 30, 40 years with one business. There's very much the sense that I might spend a year or two here, and then I'm going to go to a better position at this company, and then a better position at this company. And that might mean moving different cities, it might mean different states, or might even mean different countries for a lot of young adults. And so one of the reasons we're seeing a lot of couples have to really delay marital transitions is because for now, most of these couples that are dual income and dual career couples, there's this sense of, you know, we had to spend 3 years in different states. That was one of the things I heard a lot in my interviews, particularly right after the college transition for a lot of them, is they, you know, started dating in college and someone got an internship in Texas and another one got a job up in Ohio. And there was this sense of, okay, the next 3-4 years, we're going to be in that long distance relationship. And that's becoming more and more common as well.
Brian, are you staying with us? No.
Yeah.
You are. Okay, great, good, because
yeah.
I want you to.
Yeah.
That's Brian Willoughby. He's an associate professor at Brigham Young University. He is the author of a new book entitled The Marriage Paradox, Why Emerging Adults Love Marriage, Yet Push It Aside. We're going to hear from some more callers who have their take on this issue. And if you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We're talking about Marriage of Millennials. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. There are plenty of fish in the sea, sure, but are there too many to choose from when it comes to settling down in a relationship, let alone getting married? Thanks to dating apps, hundreds of potential dating options are at the fingertips of marriage-aged Americans today. For many, the choice is overwhelm, and that plays a role in the number of millennials who will marry. Still with us by phone is associate professor at Brigham Young University and author of the book entitled The Marriage Paradox, Why Emerging Adults Love Marriage Yet Push It Aside, Brian Willoughby. And Brian, thanks again for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
So what about that whole dating thing again? I mean, are people just having a hard time settling down because there's too many options?
Yeah, that is another big part of this, is that, as you said, our dating options have exploded for this generation. It used to be that my dating options were my people in my local church or my local area, maybe my college area. And now young adults have access through the internet, through social media, through dating apps and dating websites to virtually almost everyone. And that's created this kind of shopping mentality for a lot of them. As I talk about this particular issue to people, sometimes I relate this to going to the grocery store and trying to pick that one perfect apple. We see all those apples out there, and we pick each one up, and we're looking for any little flaw in it because we know there's a perfect one in there somewhere. And that's how a lot of young adults now approach dating. And that's tied to what we call soulmate belief, which has also been shifting, is most young adults don't necessarily believe in one person out there, one perfect soulmate for them. But they do believe, the phrasing I heard a lot in my interviews is they're looking for the right one. There is someone out there, a group of people that's going to be better for me than anyone else. And when I'm faced with all these options, it can be daunting and sometimes frightening to try to figure out, have I picked the right one or can I find the right one?
Joining us now by phone, founder of the dating advice column for millennials, The Babe Report, and the author of a new book entitled Aren't You Glad You Read This? The Complete How-To Guide for Singles with a History of Failed Relationships Who Want Their Next Relationship to Succeed, Erica Gordon. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you.
This is a thing that singles have histories of failed relationships. There must be enough of them out there that inspired you to actually write a book. What are we talking about here?
Well, I think a big issue is actually how dating apps are causing too much choice, which ruins dating. Choice ruins dating.
How so?
Well, so dating apps like Tinder have definitely increased our opportunities, but they've impaired our ability to embrace opportunities. So at first, it seems like dating apps are boosting our odds and leading to more dating opportunity. And that seems like a good thing at first. But enter the paradox of choice, which causes the illusion of endless options to cause us to be less satisfied with each individual option and will therefore place less value on each option and be less likely to pursue each option.
How much do people talk about what they want out of a relationship when they're dating in this way? What do they talk about?
On these particular dating apps, most people are not looking for a relationship. I think having an abundance of options, yet not finding anything real among them is really the ultimate dating paradox. Someone on Twitter compared it to being starving in a grocery store. And I couldn't agree more. I feel that we have more choice than any previous generation, and yet we feel more alone than any previous generation.
Because I'm interested, and Brian Willoughby, chime in, how does this whole dating app culture actually work with our human nature and how we actually socialize and get to know each other?
Yeah, and that is one of the other issues, is that, as was said, you know, a lot of these apps are set up away from what we know as typical relationship formation, where I usually get to know someone, I talk to them, we have an interaction between the two of us, and now most of our dating apps have resorted to me looking at a picture, and right swiping or left swiping or clicking on their profile, poking them, and we lose then that interaction. And so before we even get to what's supposed to be the beginning of relationships, where I'm making choices based on common interests and how we interact together, I'm making choices based on your hair color and your height and your hobbies and what I'm reading on your profile. And that sets up this expectation. We create these images and these idealized images of what people are supposed to be like, and they very rarely are going to live up to that. And then we get, as was said, this paradox of choice, where when you don't live up to this expectation I have of you, well, I know I've got thousands of other options. And I start doing what we call alternative seeking, which I start, you know, even if I'm dating you, even if I'm going to give you a couple dates to see how things are going to go, I'm also keeping one eye over here and scrolling through these profiles to see what my backup is. And as soon as we do that, we lose what I feel like is the foundation of any stable relationship, which is commitment.
Yeah. We're talking about the paradox of marriage for the millennial generation. Mostly today, they're at the marrying age, and they like it, but they're doing it later, and they're doing it for different reasons, and they're putting it off for different reasons as well. Neil in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're a millennial, right?
I'm a millennial.
All right.
I was born in 91, which makes me 26 now.
Okay.
And my girlfriend is also 26. We've been together for about a year now, but we've known each other since junior high. So we've known each other and been good friends for 10 plus years. And really what it was that brought us together was, really what it was that helped the relationship work was that we were both ready to be in a relationship, especially me. She's more mature than I am, but I wasn't ready to be in a relationship yet. And that's kind of like the stability that people have been talking about earlier, not necessarily financial, but just being comfortable with yourself. I think, man, everything that I wanted to comment on has been touched on so far.
No, but I do want to, but you haven't touched on it. And I want to hear what I've been told is that you're saying that you won't get married because of financial burden. Why do you see marriage as a financial burden?
Because I guess maybe for lack of understanding of how marriage actually works financially, it just seems like it's something that does have a big financial sign over it, where everything else that we would think goes into a marriage, we'd like to spend more time doing that. We just recently moved into each other. Maybe it just doesn't make sense for us to, it doesn't make business sense for us to,
Brian Willoughby, I mean, doesn't the research show that people who are married are more financially stable?
Yeah, and that.
Are you there, Brian?
Emotionally stable.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know, like when they're relationship wise stable. If that's not working, then I think you're getting yourself into trouble.
Yeah, and there is, I think we're touching on this idea, because you're right, is marriage does generally make people more financially stable, and it does tend to actually help finances for the same reason that moving in helps finances, that now we have one rent and we're sharing resources. But I think we're tapping into something that's important, that there is this generalized anxiety about marriage, as we've been talking about, that for a lot of young adults and millennials, there's this sense, and this is something I hit on a lot in the interviews I did with young adults, when they talk about marriage, is they can't quite put their finger on it. They just have the sense that marriage is going to make things hard. I don't know why. Uh-huh. I don't know exactly when. It's just going to make things harder. And that's scary.
You know, Erica Gordon, is this a chicken before the egg? What comes first? I mean, is this, when it comes to the dating apps and everything, is this whole dating app culture exacerbating this fear of marriage? Did it become popular because of the fear of marriage? What do you think?
I think the fear of marriage has a lot to do with the fear of missing out. I think that dating apps have put all of these choices in the forefront of our minds. But rather than making possibilities for finding love limitless, the choices have put limits on our ability to give love. Mm. So we're basically fearing that we're missing out on someone or something which does you know, relate to being fearful of marriage.
And so I want to go back to Neil real quick. Neil, did you use dating apps before you got together with your girlfriend?
No, I didn't. I never really believed in that.
But you had to have friends who did it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I didn't see it successful most of the time because when you with these dating apps, it's almost like today everything is a commodity. So it's like we're picking and choosing how we want our life to look, but we're not really focusing on ourselves and what makes us feel good. And I think it's only then that you can really appreciate somebody else in your life.
Neil, thanks a lot for your call today. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Listeners out there, if you're a millennial, give us a call. Tell us what you think about marriage these days. We're talking about the marriage paradox. My guest is Brian Willoughby. He's an associate professor at Brigham Young University. He's the author of the book, The Marriage Paradox, Why Emerging Adults Love Marriage Yet Push It Aside. Also with us, Erica Gordon, founder of The Babe Report. She's author of a new book as well, Aren't You Glad You Read This? The Complete Guide to How-To Guide for Singles with a History of Failed Relationships Who Want Their Next Relationship to Succeed. Erica Gordon, is one of the first things you tell them to get rid of the stupid dating apps?
Yes, I think what I'm wanting people to get from my book, or one of the main things, is the rewards that come with dating one person at a time. Because we all know that you have this gift of choice, if you want to call it a gift. I don't actually think that being able to choose is a privilege. I think it's actually a disadvantage. And I want people to realize how many benefits there are when you do just date one person at a time, because that's you giving it a real shot if you do that.
Email from Joe. He says, I'm a 33-year-old man, and I don't view marriage as anything more than a tax break opportunity. I'm not religious, and I don't want children. I echo what the professor says. It is largely for economic reasons, student debt, rent, low wages, and I'm a college professor, too, that I feel like marriage isn't for me. Thanks a lot, Joe, for that. Email from Ben says, I am not a millennial. Rather, I'm part of the previous generation. I don't feel marriage is all it's cracked up to be. From a personal experience, my father is on his fourth marriage and my mother is on her third. Therefore, I just don't see what the rush is to marry. My girlfriend and I have been together for over 6 years. We talk of marriage down the road, but we look at real life. We both are in school, and if we were to marry, we would lose our financial aid. Okay, well, there's a drawback right there, Brian Willoughby, right. But you do write and talk about in your book the experiences of people with their own family growing up, and it rubs different ways depending on the person, right?
Yeah, exactly. That family experience, particularly with one's parents, is a very, very important factor in how people approach marriage, because that is, for most of us, the most proximate in-your-face example of what marriage was like. And we know that for those that saw their parents divorced and possibly divorced multiple times, it's hard to have a lot of confidence in an institution like marriage when you saw it create so much heartache in your own family, in your own life, and you went through that with your parents, maybe both of your parents several times. It's hard to then buy into this, that it's worth all that hassle and all that heartache, because look what it can do. When you didn't see a lot of positive examples, and our media doesn't give us a lot of positive examples about marriage, it's easy to have that mindset. We see those with divorced or single parents have much lower and less positive attitudes about marriage than those that had continually married parents.
Erica Gordon, have you seen the same sort of patterns in your work giving advice?
Yes, I think there's a lot of traditions that the older generations that we have lost in our generation. We've been dubbed the non-romantic generation for that reason. Our parents definitely knew romance better, how to do it, how to embrace it, stuff like that.
Yeah, it makes me sad. Ben's been with the same person for 6 years, and they're only kind of talking about it maybe someday.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get, like, a big urge. What about Brian Willoughby having children? I mean, is this much of a compulsion or not?
Yeah, people still do want to have kids, although a lot of the same things we've been talking about are at play there. People are delaying having children. They want to have fewer children. And I would say even more so than marriage, children now in the current generation are seen as something that are going to get something that's going to get in the way. Kids are expensive. They limit your travel opportunities. They travel independence. And again, with so many dual career couples, there's this sense of does it make sense if one of us has to give us a career, we're going to have to spend one of our incomes on childcare expenses for that child. All of those things are there. Now, having said that, most people still want to become parents. And this is something I found that actually creates some marriage paradox beliefs for young adults, because this adds this fertility kind of time bomb to their decision about getting married. Because most young adults, particularly most middle class and upper middle class young adults in college, still want to be married before they have kids. There's a pretty big economic, socioeconomic divide with that. But most, like I said, those in the upper socioeconomic part of our country still want to get married before they have kids. And so that puts this kind of upper limit on when I can get married. Because if I push marriage too far back, then there's this concern of, well, am I going to have kids? Am I going to have fertility issues if I wait too long? And so a lot of the young adults I talked to said, well, even if I don't want to get married and I'm not sure about marriage and I have all these anxieties, if I wait too far into my 30s, I'm worried that I'm going to have a fertility issue.
Yeah.
And I think we might be having in this upcoming generation a little bit of a group that might start actually settling and possibly some relationships they're not very happy in because they're worried about that fertility issue.
Alia in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thanks.
I am a married millennial. I'm 26 and my husband's 27, and we've been married for maybe 4 years, but we've been together for 7.
Wow.
And yeah, it's a long time for us, maybe not in the long, you know, run.
No,
but
it's a long time.
For
congratulations.
Us,
yeah.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. For us, I guess it was just the next step in our relationship. I come from a family with divorced parents. So for me, being married was this huge deal because of the commitment aspect. I figured if you're going to have a family or start a family, you should go all the way with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I see a lot of my peers not getting married for, you know, the same reasons that maybe they're not moving out of their house, their parents' houses right now.
Mm-hmm.
They can't afford to get married. They can't afford their own homes. They can't afford to not live with their parents. So why get married and start a family? We can barely find jobs that adequately suit us and satisfy us. So if we can't find things in life that are going to satisfy us, I feel like a lot of people aren't going to seek that out in a person, in a permanent person. Because there's just a lot that we're realizing that we can't control.
Yeah.
So I see a lot of my friends that do get married, they get divorced like 2 years after.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of women, my sister, for instance, is choosing to have a relationship without marriage, but bringing a family into it because she just feels like marriage brings on this extra pressure. And she's a feminist. So she's like,
she doesn't feel the need.
Why do I need to get married? Right.
Yeah.
Why, and I understand that. I'm also a feminist, but I'm a feminist who's married.
Uh-huh.
So that's another thing I feel like for women these days, especially young women who didn't get a sense of identity. So now we're finding it. And getting married kind of hinders that whole sense of self-identity for a lot of people. So
I wanted to get at one more thing, and Alia, you reminded me of that. Thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. And again, congratulations and good luck. Brian Willoughby, gender roles are changing.
Right.
You wrote that it's much more balanced in millennial relationships.
Yeah, and this in a lot of ways has been a very positive thing, that millennials have really embraced this egalitarian view of marriage, where men and women can have careers, they can do everything, that they're sharing responsibilities much more than their parents' generation did. And so that's great. Now, at the same time, though, as I said before, as the caller was kind of talking about, this has also created some potential barriers, because if everything's equal and we both want each other to succeed in our work life and our career and everything else that we're doing, our personal hobbies, again, that idea of marriage, which by nature for a lot of us is going to require some sacrifice on both of our parts to make it work so we can interblend our lives. it makes it a little bit more difficult, because how are we going to give things up? Who's going to decide to give what up? What if that means that, like I said before, well, I have a job offer across the country. Are you going to quit your job? Are you going to try to move? How are we going to do that? And marriage kind of forces us to make those decisions. Versus if we're just dating, we can then look at it and say, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't be dating anymore. Maybe we need to move on to other people. It makes life, I think, simpler for them in terms of some of those decisions.
We are going to be turning the conversation to two groups of people out there for whom it wasn't simple at one point in time, people who were in interracial marriages and also people who wanted to be in same-sex marriages. We'll look at that post U.S. Supreme Court decisions. So I need to say goodbye to Brian Willoughby. Brian, thanks so much. You've been great guest. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Brian Willoughby is an associate professor at Brigham Young University. He's also the author of a new book entitled The Marriage Paradox, Why Emerging Adults Love Marriage, Yet Push It Aside. And Erica Gordon, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Erica Gordon, author of a new book entitled Aren't You Glad You Read This? The Complete How-To Guide for Singles with a History of Failed Relationships Who Want Their Next Relationship to Succeed. She's also founder of the Babe Report. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org. More coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We've been talking about the tradition of marriage and how millennials' views differ from those of their parents and previous generations. Now we turn to two huge changes that came about because of U.S. Supreme Court decisions. Interracial marriage 50 years ago and same-sex marriage 2 years ago. Acceptance of both has increased, at least on the surface. My next guests have studied what that acceptance looks like and what it means. Joining us by phone is Allison Skinner. She's postdoctoral research associate at Northwestern University. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Also by phone, Robert J. Green, founder of the Rockway Institute for Research in LGBT Psychology and Public Policy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How has the legalization of same-sex marriage changed or affected how same-sex couples view marriage?
Well, I don't have data on that question in particular, but we do know that the vast majority of same-sex couples who are living together want the right to get married. In fact, it's upwards of 87% in the surveys we've done. So they certainly desire marriage. And studies that have been done of LGBT youth, a very high percentage of them intend to get married at some point in their lives. It's, again, around 80%.
Is it worth comparing and contrasting same-sex marriages versus heterosexual marriages and what the values are going into them?
How do you mean?
Do they differ?
No, I think heterosexuals and LGBT people are seeking the same thing from marriage. You know, companionship, security, an ongoing committed sexual relationship, devotion through sickness and health till death do you part. It's the same motivations that lead people into committed relationships, regardless of sexual orientation.
You did a study of 976 couples who in 2008 were registered domestic partners in California. You followed them over a five-year period to look at which of them got married, which ones stayed together unmarried, and which what did you find out about them? What did that research tell you?
Yeah, we found out two very important things, that couples who married were more likely to be getting along better in the first place, meaning they had less anger and aggression in their relationship, more nurturance and support towards each other, more open communication with one another. But also, interestingly, they had less what's called internalized homophobia. By that I mean they were more likely to be accepting of themselves for being lesbian, gay, or bisexual than were the couples that did not get married. So it was almost as if the couples that couldn't accept themselves for being lesbian, gay, or bisexual were the ones who couldn't take advantage of the new marital status that was provided by the U.S. Supreme Court decision.
Was it a sense of worthiness? Like I'm worthy of this, I'm fully this, I'm going to show it to the world kind of a thing?
Yeah, that's certainly a component of what we mean by self-acceptance for being lesbian, gay, or bisexual.
Huh. Allison Skinner, interracial marriage has been legal for 50 years now. In 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Loving versus Virginia. So that's a lot of time to look at what the impact of that has been. Have the rates of marriage between races changed much in 50 years?
Yeah, I mean, that's not an area of my research, but I know that census estimates indicate that they've increased considerably. I can't remember exactly what the numbers are, but mm-hmm. they've gone from being probably like less than 1% to being, I want to say that somewhere in the ballpark of maybe 10% of new newlywed couples are interracial, perhaps even a little bit higher than that.
But your research shows that even though those rates are much higher, and that on a surface level, Americans are increasingly supportive and accepting of it, that at another level, there's this more subliminal attitudes by Americans being raised in a racist culture like it is, that their subliminal attitudes are something that you can study now, right?
Yeah. So they're the sort of explicit acceptance of interracial marriage is almost universal. Almost everyone says it's okay. It's pretty unpopular to be against interracial marriage in the current society. But my research has, looked at sort of unconscious associations, or at least associations we're often unconscious of, that sort of associate interracial marriage with something negative. And what we find is that, in fact, actually most people show biases against interracial marriage. And that is true across a number of different racial groups that we've looked at as well.
Did you look at Robert J. Greene interracial marriage in LGBT or same-sex marriage?
We have the data to analyze. We haven't analyzed it yet, but I have some other students who've done, doctoral students who've done research on interracial marriage, and it seems to me one of the fundamental issues is family of origin acceptance of the marriage. And, that's where the rubber sort of hits the road. Does each partner's family of origin accept the interracial marriage? Are they supportive, or is there continuing reluctance to accept the partner as a bona fide spouse? And I think this is still one of the fundamental issues that interracial couples face.
Allison Skinner, did you touch upon that at all in your research?
So my research has really all focused on perceptions of interracial couples rather mm-hmm. than the experience of being someone who's involved in an interracial relationship.
Mm-hmm. And do those perceptions of couples, do we know if it matters to couples how they're perceived? Are they aware of it? Do we know that?
Well, there is not. That's also sort of outside of my area of research, but I think that anecdotally I would say yes. And when we look at, there is some literature looking at people's willingness to engage in interracial relationships, and a lot of times people mention things about their families and their communities' acceptance as reasons that they might be hesitant or they might avoid an interracial relationship.
So why, what do you make of this enduring subliminal or how you, unconscious perceptions of interracial marriage in the United States? Why, after 50 years, does that endure?
Well, we're trying to look into that with some of our research. We looked at how, if people had contact with interracial couples, so if they knew people personally who were involved in interracial relationships, and we found that among people who had personal contact with interracial couples, their biases were much lower. So perhaps to some extent, it's the fact that it's sort of unfamiliar, it's foreign, and therefore we sort of have biases against it, that that's at least contributing to the bias.
Does it matter at all what the racial unions are, what the makeup is, whether it's Hispanic and white or black and white or what, or black and Hispanic? Does that affect the outcomes at all?
I suspect that it does, but our research has actually all focused so far on black-white interracial couples.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unclear exactly. And I think it also depends on who you're asking. And I think to some extent people may have more bias against a member of their own group engaging in an interracial relationship. So a white person might have more problem with a black-white interracial relationship than a black-Asian interracial relationship because they're both sort of members of another group and it's perhaps less concerning or threatening.
Robert J. Green, as this other group of married, legally married people emerges in the United States coming out of 2 years ago in the U.S. Supreme Court decision, what are the questions that you're going to be asking going forward as a researcher?
Yeah, what I'm most interested in looking at is how prejudice in the form of what we call microaggressions, which means small acts of discrimination, everyday acts of discrimination that same-sex couples experience, how those acts of discrimination impact their functioning. So there's three areas to look at here. One is how much discrimination does the couple experience? Secondly, how do they cope with incidents of discrimination? And thirdly, what's the psychological impact and the relational impact of those acts of microaggression? And that's what we're looking into now. The preliminary analysis we've done of the data shows that the couples who report experiencing a higher rate of microaggressions in their environments are actually functioning less well. So that implies that discrimination from the outside world is negatively impacting same-sex marriage relationships.
But to the extent and all the different nuances therein are yet to be revealed.
Yeah. Right? Well, I mean, we have some data on the extent, and it's the reports are microaggressions tend to be very low rate. They're not occurring with huge frequency.
Okay.
But the problem, I see, when you're in a minority group, the problem is each incident of discrimination is a sign of how vulnerable you are all the time,
mm-hmm.
to incidents of discrimination. So the minority consciousness of vulnerability to discrimination is something that you carry with you all the time, and each incident is just a reminder, but you know it could happen again tomorrow or the next day or the next day.
Right.
So it's not just the impact of the incident, that the impact of feeling so vulnerable to it happening again and again.
Robert J. Green, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Okay, thank you.
Robert J. Green, founder of the Rockway Institute for Research in LGBT Psychology and Public Policy. Allison Skinner, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Allison Skinner, postdoctoral research associate at Northwestern University, whose research has been on unconscious perceptions of interracial marriages. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia LaNott, the All Sides interns Kelly Rudolph, Kyle McKinnon, Aaron Kinkley, and Owen Doherty. Kelly Rudolph produced this show. Video production is by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.